A lot of times when you get into these alternative categories, the economics can look really good, but then when they become correlated to the replacement technology, the economics, you know, don't perform as well. And that certainly happened in biodiesel.
Welcome to Positive. Find us on Twitter at POSI, the number 2IVE. This bi-weekly podcast is for active investors and founders just like you, focused on venture scale positive impacts. I'm your host, Zeka Len, an angel investor in the private capital markets here in sunny SoCal.
Today's guest is Martin Tobias, an angel investor from the Northwest. This episode will include three sections. First, reducing friction. Next, the future of software. And last, counterintuitive and right. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Hi, Zeka. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I really want to just, you have such an amazing background, and I know our guests will love getting so many of your insights as a long-term angel investor. Can you give us your, just a general sense of how you got into impact and angel investing?
Yeah. You know, I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. I started with a Kool-Aid stand when I was 5 years old and, you know, loved capitalism, but I've always loved things that solve problems. The problem I had when I was 5 years old is that I wanted this radio that looked like an asteroid, and my parents wouldn't buy it for me. So my solution was to start a Kool-Aid stand to get it, get what I wanted. And, you know, I've kind of just always been attracted to people that are personally passionate about something, you know, that have a drive to do something other people wouldn't do. And, you know, I went, my first job out of college was at Anderson Consulting. And the reason I went there is that I wanted to learn about a lot of different industries because I didn't know which one I wanted to work at. I ended up as a consultant at Microsoft, and I loved the entrepreneurial spirit of Microsoft before Windows 3 launch. And so I went there. And at Microsoft, I worked with a lot of startups to create electronic software distribution, the beginnings of downloadable software. And that got me passionate about entrepreneurs solving new problems. So after Microsoft, I started a software company. I've started three companies. I've invested in over 100 companies. I'm a limited partner in 12 venture funds. And right now, what I'm doing full time is just supporting entrepreneurs with capital in this little venture fund that I have. And for me, it's the most rewarding thing I can do because I get to really help entrepreneurs get their vision out there.
Well, I really love your story. And I also love that you have a background in consulting. I think there's something that comes from consulting and people that gear themselves to a broader scope of understandings that really lends well to venture capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
Let's maybe move right into our first section with reducing friction. Tell me about kind of when you first branched out and you started looking at angel investments. How did that go for you? What was that process like?
When I first started looking at what I wanted to invest in, I had to decide, you know, am I going to be one of these any good deal investors that just try to pile on to whatever somebody else says is good? Or am I going to have a thesis of my own that I believe would, you know, correlate to higher returns? And one of my core theses that I came up with was this idea that any innovation, especially software, really has to reduce friction in a material way. And if it does that, over time, you'll generate a value because you're reducing friction. There are tons of software ideas that don't, in fact, reduce friction. But I'd like to talk about two that I invested in. So, for example, I invested in Amazon at the IPO. And one of the reasons I did is that I said, you know, what they're doing is using software to basically reduce friction in the retail environment. You know, Walmart's core asset was basically, you know, building big physical stores. Amazon said, we're going to use software to increase the range of products people can buy, use one-click ordering. And you just look at everything Amazon's done. It's all designed to reduce friction all the way down to like same-day delivery, drones, and stuff like that. And they've always stayed focused on reducing friction. And by reducing friction, they're increasing the value to the consumer. I actually did an interesting exercise I looked at, you know, investing in Amazon in 2000 versus Walmart. At the time, Walmart was 100 times bigger than Amazon. But if you had invested $10,000 in Amazon in 2000 and Walmart in 2000, by today, you would have roughly $100,000 in Walmart stock, and you'd have roughly $20 million in Amazon stock. The fact that Amazon stayed focused on reducing friction and has grown share at roughly three times the rate of Walmart for 20 years is because they focus on reducing friction in the retail process. You know, a second company that I invested in at a time when it was unclear it was going to be good at all was DocuSign. And the reason I invested in DocuSign is that I had had all of the pain of trying to sign documents in a real estate transaction or non-disclosures, faxing things around. And I said, this signing thing is just too much friction for a very simple thing. People used to fax me stuff and I'd have to have a fax machine. And at the time, you know, digital signatures were not even legal in most states. So it was a long-term bet, but my bet was fundamentally the software would significantly reduce friction in, you know, many, many transactions, and that people would pay for the convenience gained by that reduction of friction. And that's turned out to be true. So
amazing. I actually want to go back to what you said right from the get-go on any good deal, that aspect of maybe something that some investors feel as though if they have less conviction, they take that collaborative any good deal approach maybe originally. And I like how you stepped out and maybe you put a little bit more faith into your own line of thinking. I think that's bold. And did you feel at the time that you saw other investors just doing the same thing, more collaborative, more broad, more general?
Well, I mean, I still see that today. I mean, everybody who buys the S&P 500 index, that's what they're doing, right? They're giving up their own agency and just trusting somebody else to make the decisions. I'm not saying that's a terrible, strategy. In fact, for my public market equities where I haven't bought them myself, I have lots of passive money. But if you are going to be active and making a decision, you have to have your own thesis. Most angel investors don't. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't know what yours would be. I mean, I explained two of mine, but I think it's very important if you're going to be an angel investor that you have some opinions that have been informed over time. And my meta themes, which we'll talk a little bit about later, the seven themes that I invest in now at Incisive Ventures have been informed by 25 years of angel investing and, you know, doing the diligence to say what bets were right, what bets were wrong, what did I know at the time, what themes did I believe in have in fact correlated to higher returns. You know, following other smart investors is not a terrible strategy. It's just usually not an optimal strategy in my
Understood.
Experience.
That's really, I appreciate you being so candid about it and sharing the why. It's really important, I think, for our listeners. And I think founders should also recognize that there is value in their own conviction as well, and to try to align with investors who may be able to see the writing on the wall. Can we go back to DocuSign for a minute and kind of break out into what was the TAM on DocuSign when you first saw it? How do you even compare something like that?
Well, that's it as well. I mean, I did not invest in Uber, but you know, what was the market size for Uber before Uber launched? It was zero.
Yeah.
What was the market size for DocuSign before DocuSign launched? It was zero. I mean, nobody was doing digital signatures. It was not even a market. And you know, the best kind of innovation, you know, if it's reducing friction in a pain point that a lot of people have, like DocuSign did, it can create its own category and its own market. And if you end up investing in one of those companies that created a category, like Amazon, like DocuSign, like Dropbox, like Tesla, that's when you tend to get the real outsized returns relative to investing in the second person. You know, I have a friend that invested in EcoSign, which was a competitor to DocuSign. Nobody has. They got bought by Adobe. But I mean, you know, they ended up with, you know, an order of magnitude smaller return because it wasn't the category creator. So, you know, it's getting to also something we'll talk about in the third section. You know, your thesis has to be counterintuitive and right. I mean, at the time when I invested in DocuSign, people were like, the fax machine works fine. Digital signatures are illegal. Why would I do that? Well, because fundamentally it's reducing friction in a huge area, and people are willing to pay for convenience. And you have to be right about your conviction. There were plenty of things, you know, for example, I looked at early, about the same time, a company that was trying to do online voting. And my thesis there was that online voting would not ever be safe enough, and it was not reducing enough friction. And I didn't do the investment, and I was right about that too. I mean, we still have paper ballots most places here 20 years later.
Yeah, and if there are digital voting stations, they can't necessarily scale because of some of the other frictions that may be non-obvious software frictions, it sounds like.
That's true. Yeah, and you know, that's a regulated industry where people are going to have a lot of concerns there, and the digital voting that there is are these machine-based things which have to be audited by the government. It's not something that's going to lend itself very well to, you know, voting by your phone. There's just too much chance for fraud in that case.
Well, tell us more about your involvement with E8. Can you tell us just briefly what they are? I hope to get them on the show as well. I don't want to give away everything there, but and what led you kind of more in the direction of impact? At what point did you start thinking in those terms?
Sure. So Element 8 is a angel network in Seattle of about 100 guys that do early stage clean tech investing. And I started that network basically when I left Ignition. I started a company called Imperium Renewables, which was doing biodiesel. And at the time, when I was raising money, I went to the traditional angel networks like in Seattle, and they had seen a lot of technology deals, software deals, and they're like, what is this clean tech thing? I don't understand. But I met a lot of individuals who wanted to learn and understand about clean tech investing, but all they saw were software deals. So I created Element 8. It started as Northwest Energy Angels, but as a forum where half the meeting we would have a presentation, an education thing to educate traditional tech investors about what clean tech was. So we'd have somebody come in from Puget Sound Power and talk about power purchase agreements or carbon credits. So it was half education, half deal pitch. And, you know, that turned out to be really good for the angel community because they could learn the context of the industry before they invested in companies. I know Element 8 is doing very well now. They have a small fund where they invest and they're very active. They've put lots and lots of money into deals. And I really created it just because there was nowhere where angel investors could see a lot of climate-related deals and get educated about how to invest and think about the clean tech market. So it worked out great.
And what year did you exit out of Imperium?
2009.
Wow! Right during the heyday of clean fuels and such.
Well, yeah, it was a heyday, but I mean, Imperium, you know, was on. We got all the way on file to go public, and then they, you know, the market kind of deteriorated in the fall of 2008, and they decided to wait till 2009, and the market was worse for fundraising then, unfortunately. You know, I wish we'd have gotten it public sort of before the market cratered, because it was we built the biggest biodiesel refinery in the world in Grace Harbor, Washington. And, you know, we were doing economics that were favorable. The other thing that I learned in that business is, you know, don't fight with somebody, you know, who buys their oil by the barrel, like they talk about in publishing. The oil industry, you know, has infinite amounts of money. I was stoked. You know, we were doing, I think we did $80 million in revenue in 2008 at Imperium. Exxon did $20 billion in one quarter. You know, and that's who you're competing against. It's really, really hard for startups to compete in a huge capital intensive business like that. And then when, you know, it was good. One of the learnings from the whole clean tech thing is a lot of clean tech investments can be very good when the government programs are in your favor. And in biodiesel, there was a dollar a gallon credit, tax credit, which really helped subsidize the extra production cost in biodiesel. But of course, the oil lobby got that terminated. And then all of a sudden, your economics are upside down and you can't compete. So, you know, that happens in wind and solar, the boom and bust of tax credits. And that's one of the things that doesn't tend to happen in software businesses. And that's a risk a lot of clean tech investors have to look at is how much of the business plan of this business is based on tax credits or something like that. You know, luckily, people like Tesla have been able to, you know, use that $7,500 tax credit and scale up. And now they're big enough where they don't get that tax credit, but people love the product enough, they buy it anyway.
Right?
Not all clean tech companies are able to jump that shark and operate economically without the credits.
Yeah, that's really insightful. I remember taking an econ class way back in the day. It was an environmental economics class, and the professor said, "Just watch out when the price of oil is really high. People love the environment." And does that resonate with you?
Yeah. And when it's low, they don't care. And you know, we went through a crazy time there. I mean, in 2008 and 2009. Early there, you know, oil was up to $120, $130 a barrel.
Yeah,
and then it delevered back to 40. And at $40 a barrel, biodiesel was like two or three times more expensive. Like your margins can get crushed very quickly in that.
Yeah.
Kind of,
and do you think with an environment as such, with very slow recovery in the oil market, biodiesel and other sort of switching alternatives have become less attainable, especially without credits?
Yes, they have. But the real reason they have is that, you know, something I didn't realize when I went into Imperium, because when I started Imperium, one of the thesis was, hey, we're going to take this thing over here, which is not oil, like palm oil or canola oil, and we're going to convert it to this other thing. And when you back tested the correlation of commodities for 20 years, you found no correlation because they were two totally different markets. So you go, okay, this is a good way to arbitrage because the markets aren't correlated. Yeah. Unfortunately, when you build the biggest biodiesel refinery in the world and you build enough capacity to efficiently make this one thing into the other thing, all of a sudden the markets become correlated. That's what happened with corn, for example. And ethanol, you know, the price of corn is driven as much by the price of oil now as for the demand for food, because some huge percentage of our corn goes to make ethanol. So a lot of times when you get into these alternative categories, the economics can look really good, but then when they become correlated to the replacement technology, the economics, you know, don't perform as well. And that certainly happened in biodiesel. And that's happened in corn ethanol too. You're making so much of it that the price of the commodity is now more driven by the price of the oil than it is by the food price.
Oh my. Well, that's a very complex environment to work in. And I'm glad you made it so far. I mean, that's amazing where you got to. A lot of people, I'm sure never made it even close to that far.
No, they didn't.
So you went from renewable oil mogul to kind of back to clean. Did you stay with clean tech after that?
No. I went back and did some software stuff. I started a company called Tipper, which was competing with a white label version of Groupon. Where I again learned firsthand that you don't want to be the follower in a market, that because Groupon was defining that category and we were the follower and we were valued much less than
they were. Yeah, I see. I see, indeed. And so you have this entrepreneurial zeal to be an operator that keeps kind of popping
coming
its head
back
up for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But okay, well, I see it and it's wonderful. And I think it can be applied to investing as well to think like that. So let's lead us into the second section on the future of software, because software is kind of where your wheelhouse is right now. What about the current venture and kind of how you see software in the future going forward?
I see it as a lot of the same, you know, focusing on software applications that reduce friction. A lot of people are writing software things that, you know, digitization of everything, but the software doesn't really deliver, you know, an order of magnitude benefit. I have a post on my website, incisive.vc, of the seven meta themes. And the first one is software eats everything. And I hear that a lot from, you know, CEOs like, my company is software eats, but they're misunderstanding the analogy. You know, at Uber, software ate the taxi business because right. the software actually enabled the rideshare market, which was non-existent, to grow. And now there's something like 100 times more people taking temporary rides than ever took taxis. The market's bigger. The cost to run the market's cheaper because of the software. And that's software eating another industry. Most software ideas don't eat another industry. You know, Amazon ate Walmart, DocuSign ate the fax machine, but not every software idea is a software eats idea. You've got to have the software deliver an order of magnitude benefits at a lower cost or scalability. And not every software idea does that. You know, to some extent, you know, Tesla is more of a software company because, you know, if you look at it, you know, the not only do they have less moving parts than internal combustion, they can software upgrade their cars over the air, which other cars can't do. The long-term maintenance is less, and it's all because of the software that, you know, the driving, the self-driving is all software. You know, so while they're still making a physical product, the software is what's making their product more useful and more valuable than products without the software.
And what are some of the other meta themes? Excuse me.
Yeah, software eats. You know, another one is, you know, great founders figure shit out. And I don't know if I can say that on the podcast.
You can say it twice.
But, you know, when you're investing early, even with a little bit of customer traction, in my weighting of what's important, you know, the management is 50 or 60% of my weight. And many investors will look and, you know, overweight, like I mentioned, any good deal. They'll say, oh, you know, Sequoia is in, so therefore I'm in. And they'll use a signal to invest that somebody else thinks it's a good deal, as opposed to, and that's in my mind, a secondary investment signal. A primary investment signal is the management. At the end of the day, an early stage company is all about management. Companies don't fail because of competitors. They fail because they don't execute typically. And they don't execute because of management. And, you know, so I've developed a whole framework of how to diligence management. And some of the things I do, for example, I, you know, ask the CEO if they meditate. I haven't invested in a company for the last 3 years where the CEO doesn't meditate.
Interesting.
Why is that? It's because, you know, if a CEO is burning the candle at both ends and has no resilience practice or no way to reboot themselves to continue to handle the stress, they're going to burn out.
Wow. I have to share a micro story with you about that, if it's anecdotal or not. Last night, I was in a clubhouse room with about 20 people, and Michael Dell popped in the room, and we all had an opportunity to ask him questions. He took a rapid fire question from all of us, and there was one question I actually didn't get a chance to ask because he had to hop off, but I was going to ask him, how do you keep such a cool demeanor with all these questions? You just seem so calm. And I think you answered the why there.
Yeah, he probably, I don't know what it is, whether it's meditation or yoga or sports or something.
He said him and his wife go out and hike in nature quite often. And
exactly. That having that ability, especially in a startup in a busy environment, to disconnect and reboot your, you know, stress levels, however you do that. You know, this burn the candle at both ends and work 80 hours a week and, you know, work's the only thing, that's a recipe for failure.
I see. You have a lot of empathy for the experience, which I think does arm you well in that.
Because
regard.
I've been an operator, that's the other thing. I've been the CEO. And, you know, I think operator investors have a different perspective on it.
I see. Yes. Absolutely. That's really fascinating. So the primary versus the secondary approach. What are some other primaries that tie back into those, those meta themes?
Well, another meta theme of mine is that platforms win. If I see a company that has a chance of being a platform versus a feature, I'd prefer always to invest in the platform. And most companies are not thinking about a platform, they're thinking about a feature. And feature companies end up getting bought by other platform companies like Microsoft or Oracle or something like that. So I'm always on the lookout for platforms. Another theme, which I think I'm the only one that has this that I've ever seen, is that Americans are lazy.
Oh, and, interesting. Okay. I know I am. So come on, let's hear this.
Well, again, that goes back to Amazon, right? You can sit at home in your underwear, click a few buttons, and food shows up the next day. That's enabling Americans to be lazy. Anything you do that enables Americans to be lazy, even if it costs more, is likely to be successful. I mean, I can make a cup of coffee at home for 10 cents, but I often will drive to Starbucks and spend $3. Why? I'm lazy.
There you have it. There you, and you're, right? You're biased. You're from Seattle. Come on now.
I'm from Seattle. I'm biased. But, you know, you look at a lot of the most sticky and successful things. I mean, you know, Instacart, you know, lazy. Uber, lazy. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't good ideas that enable people to be more productive or whatever. But if you enable somebody to be lazy, drive through, shop at home, you know, do less clicks, you know, DocuSign, you know, I click a few buttons on my phone and the thing signed. I don't have to print something out, scan it, dial a number. It again goes back to the reduction of the friction, right? Anything which reduces friction enables you to do something else in order, you know, basically to be lazy.
Hey, I want to throw something at you. Recently, there's been a talk about community-driven startups or just this movement toward influencer communities or communities that sell collectively or advertise to the community or exit to the community or get runway traction, et cetera, into a social platform from the community. What are your thoughts about this? Is this a new idea? Have you seen this emerge before? Do you think this is a venture scale opportunity?
I don't think influencer communities are a venture scale opportunity. I do believe quite strongly in the ability of influencers and authentic people to drive, you know, adoption of products. I just spent 3 years working with Dave Asprey, the father of biohacking, you know, at Upgrade Labs. And, you know, his ability to talk about a product and get people to buy it because of his authentic use of it is through the roof. And I'm not talking about, you know, fitness influencers who, you know, post pictures of themselves and say, you can look like me. I'm talking about people that do science, do research. You know, like I listened to like Peter Attia's podcast. He's a really freaking smart guy. And he does his research. And when he says, you know, this product works, this drug works, that drug works, I know that he's done the work and I trust him more than I trust, you know, Science Magazine or, you know, the New York Times or anything like that. Real authentic influencers, I do think, have a lot of power.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't want to branch out too far into kind of these outlier cases, but I know in the pre-show you mentioned you were kind of participating in not a biohacking, but like a biotech type of experience. Can you talk more about that? Maybe share if a technology like that could be something that you'd look at or that could be venture backable?
I don't know about the biotech. I do a lot of biohacking. You know, I most things related to, you know, it's funny. Glasses are a biohack. Clothing is a biohack, right? I mean, prosthetics. It's things that change the physical experience that are not part of your body. And there's a lot of things that people call biohacks now that I think are going to become mainstream, especially around the area of people, you know, improving their sleep, like red light glasses that looked funny on Dave Asprey 5 years ago. A lot of people are wearing now because you improve your sleep because people are caring about their sleep. a lot of things that we think of as weird biohacks now, I think are going to go mainstream. I invested in, for example, Levels Health, which is a continuous glucose monitor for healthy people, not people who have diabetics, but people who want to manage their insulin levels because they care about their metabolic health. I do believe that concern over, you know, how much sugar you eat and measuring how your food affects your metabolism is going to become a mainstream thing that people are not going to think is weird within the next 3 to 5 years.
That's agreed fully. I'm absolutely on board with what you're saying there. And I really appreciate your insight about the view on biohacking. I have been thinking for a few years about the idea of augmented and or biological intelligence has been around for some time, the way we've interacted using the idea of transport and training horses to ride them and other animals and things like that, and also domestic dogs and such, how in effect we've been around with sort of this hybrid technology, so to speak, for a long time, maybe just reframing the way we look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
What about, you spoke also about real estate and property tech. Can you tell more about maybe what your interest there is, and especially with the clean tech lens?
Yeah, I mean, I had mentioned WeWork, but not as a positive example, as a negative example of, you know, the software eating thing not working. I mean, you know, WeWork is basically a real estate arbitrage. You rent real estate for one price, you fix it up, you rent it for a higher price. But they were talking about themselves like they were a software company, and they were for a time valued like they were a software company. The problem is the software that they used was not the key to their profitability, and the software did not improve the value of the property at all. It was not a technology company. And so that was kind of there are a couple of very good articles online, you know, describing, you know, how the valuation got away from it. Because, I mean, as a real estate portfolio, it's valued well, but that's like a REIT. It's never going to be Microsoft or Amazon, and it shouldn't be, because the software was not the key to the value delivered by WeWork.
Interesting.
So,
do you think that was maybe a bias that they knew was part of the narrative they wanted to perpetuate?
Of course, right. Of course. You know, he was talking about it like he's Elon Musk. Well, you know, in Tesla's case, the software does add a lot of value to the car. In WeWork's case, the software did not, and never, you know, did at the level that they were getting credit for. But obviously, they wanted that credit, and they lived for a long time until, you know, they filed their IPO and everybody looked at it and said, oh my God, this looks like a REIT and it's valued like Microsoft. Nobody bought it. They canceled the IPO. They recapped the thing at nothing. I mean, the roosters came home to roost there.
Oh my gosh. I think you're in the spirit of, in the spirit of promoting, intelligent investing here. I definitely, really admire your way of thinking, and I'm not going to on the show say negative things about any companies, but there is a really good, podcast by Acquired, a couple VCs up in Seattle who did a very excellent researched episode on WeWork along with Sequoia and others. It's a really great show. I don't know if you had a chance to check it out. I'll give them a bit of a plug.
No, I haven't. But I mean, investors, if you want to get good at investing, you have to look at, you know, some of the big flameouts and try to figure out what happened and what were investors believing that turned out to not be the case. And many times you'll find, you know, investors giving a company credit for a software multiple when it's not a software company. And I can point to 10 examples of that. So
yeah, give us a few right off the top of your head, and maybe kind of a quick why and what you may have seen on the wall that maybe others may not have at the time.
Well, WeWork was certainly one. Another one was Juiceroo, which I don't know if you saw that one. It was a home machine.
The name's kind of annoying, no offense.
Yeah, it's totally. Well, it was a machine that you basically stuck these packets in and it squeezed juice out. And they raised $120 million. They over-engineered this thing. They tried to say it was a software company. It turns out you could squeeze the juice packet with your hand quicker than the machine could do it.
There you have it.
And the software was doing nothing. They over-engineered the hell out of this thing. And that's just another one off the top of my
that's
head.
That's a good one. Let's move forward into something more constructive and sure. into the counterintuitive and right. I think what we are actually doing is transitioning well based on the conversation. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the S&P 500. You know, to be an investor with going with the crowd, it does make sense to go with something like that. It's sure. pretty much a no-brainer. The market lifts together. But what and we're talking about a little bit of the non-obvious that you see up front. I guess the main thing is, what does a process look like for you when you examine a company? Let's say at pre-seed or even at the angel round, outside of the founder and the psychology of the founder, how do you look at this through the lens of other examples?
I mentioned this thing, invest in something that's counterintuitive, and you have to be right. And that's only if you want to have outsized returns. If you want to have average returns, invest with the average investor. The S&P 500, you know, because you don't have to think, you will be average. If you want to be above average, I mean, basically the price of anything, the price of a stock, the price of a startup company, it's usually fairly valued based on the information that everybody has. If everybody thinks it's a great opportunity, it's going to be valued very highly. In order to make outsized returns, you have to believe something about the company or the market that most other investors don't, so that you get that investment at a lower price. And you have to be right about that. That's the only way you're going to outperform the market. I mean, how are you going to outperform the S&P 500? You have to make bets which other people are not making, because all the people that are making bets that you agree on, the price of that asset's going to reflect that consensus, and you're not going to get a better price, and it's not going to grow faster because everyone's going to fully price in that assumption.
Hat tip to the public market and friends who invest in ESG, because there is data evidence to suggest there's a statistical outperformance with funds who do weigh more toward ESG. I want to try to maybe break into the weights part for yourself. And maybe, for example, without being material, because I know Levels is doing extremely well. But at the time when you saw, let's say, if you want to, an example like Levels, how did you weigh and how did you diligence a deal like that when you took into regard the counterintuitive and the right aspects?
Well, the Levels investment in CGM was actually interesting, because I had been, you know, wanting someone to bring continuous glucose monitoring to the masses, to the non-diabetic masses, for a long time. And I've worn one for 3 years, and there were probably five or six companies in that space. And so I talked to all of them, and you know, I ended up putting the most money into Levels, mostly for a couple of reasons. One, the CEO there, Sam, is a really great guy, and he, you know, his weekly updates, you know, his thoughtfulness on conversations, how he thought about fundraising. And then I also was a beta tester. And just when you work with the company and you give them feedback and you see what they do and did they take it and did they appreciate it, I just got a really positive interaction. I really got the impression that he was on top of what he was doing, that he was very thoughtful. And then, of course, when Andreessen Horowitz came in and gave him $12 million, that kind of sealed the deal.
For sure.
Right. But, you know, even before Andreessen Horowitz came in, my thought was that they were executing the best, because I'd talked to them for a year and a half, and I'd seen how they evolved their product, how they evolved their UI, how they took feedback. And, you know, they were doing it better than the other companies. That's why I ended up making, you know, a larger investment in them than anybody else in that space.
Awesome. What are some other types of aspects that you're looking for, like, you know, strong opinions loosely held, or coachability, things like this that may be overlooked by a lot of other investors?
I actually don't think coachability is a good one. I want a CEO who knows what the hell they're doing. I want them to be aware and honest about their mistakes and to be able to learn from their mistakes. But if they're waiting to figure out their strategy until their investors tell them what to do, that's a really bad CEO.
I see.
So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's mostly, you know, I look at the management first. Like I say, that's 50-60% of my thesis. Not just the CEO, but the other founding team, you know, do they get along together? What's their culture? Is it a meritocracy? Is it a dictatorship? You know, how does the whole management team work? Because these are people that are going to be in the pressure cooker 80 hours a week, and do they like it? You know, are they experienced startup people? Do they know what they're doing? One thing that tends to set me against management teams is if everybody just came from another big company and they have no startup experience.
I see.
It tends to that, you know, first time entrepreneurs out of a big company tend to fail because they don't love the startup stuff. They might have gotten a little lazy in the big company stuff and not
Understood.
Be able to pivot. I can't, you know, 50-60% on management, about 20% on market. And, you know, by market, I mean the management team needs to understand how they're going to enter the market and what the thin edge of the wedge is. I don't want to see a Gartner presentation saying this market's going to be big. I want to see exactly how your product is going to launch and what is the customer perceived demand for that. In Level's case, when I invested, you know, they had a closed beta and they had a 65,000 person wait list.
That'll do it.
If you have a 65,000 person wait list
yep.
and you know, you're profitable on a closed beta, I mean, that's a huge signal. And it's not a Gartner chart. This is actual customers waiting in line to buy your product.
That's amazing. And how do you look at stage? Do you kind of gauge your IRR expectations based on stage? And when do you tend to find the sweet spot where you can add value yourself, things like that?
Well, you know, I actually wrote a post on my website called the Goldilocks stage. And a lot of people ask me what stage I invest in. A lot of VCs will say we're early stage, we're pre-seed, we're series A, whatever. Those series don't matter. To me, I'll invest in an IPO, for example. And my definition of Goldilocks stage is the just right mix of innovation and customer adoption. And that is going to lead to significant growth. Every time I write a check at whatever stage the company is at, I expect that company to return 10 times the money. If you had invested in DocuSign, you know, very early, like me, you got way more than that. But if you had invested in DocuSign at the IPO, you still got 10 times your money at the IPO, right?
Amazing.
Because they continued to innovate and grow and get market share. So the Goldilocks stage is where there's, you know, the companies continuing to, you know, the companies that stall out are ones that can, that stop their innovation. You know, and have one product that reaches saturation and they don't have a second product. You know, a great example of that is something like what happened in the scooter market with Bird. You know, Bird had amazing traction for the first 2 years, but it's still just a scooter company and they got like super big penetration and then they stopped growing. They didn't have a second product. It wasn't a platform. Like, where else do you go after scooters?
What about this, like, this intuitive part of your work? How do you deal with things that are a lot less certain for you personally? And for example, let's look out in the future, kind of let you go after this. What does it look like for you coming out of the pandemic, or what are the big opportunities in your mind?
Well, one of the things I say all the time is that angel investing is a game of incomplete information, just like poker. You know, and if you play poker, you have two cards. You have no idea what anybody else has. You have to put money at risk before you know the other cards that are going to come. And it's very much the same in angel investing. you know, whatever stage you invest in, if you invest in the seed or the A, you know a certain amount of information, but you don't know what's coming in the future. You have certain opinions of it, but you have to be comfortable with the game of incomplete information. If you're not comfortable with incomplete information and making bets that have a probability of losing, you should not be an angel investor. You should be investing in the S&P.
I'm with you there.
The whole game is incomplete information. And you're going to lose some. You know, I do play a lot of poker, and you can play poker perfectly with the odds, and things are still going to go against you. You know, I actually won a $10,000 bet on the Trump election because I was at a poker game 6 months before the election, and one of the guys said there's zero chance that Trump is going to win the election.
Oh, and wow, that's a strong bet.
I said, zero? You know, what odds are you going to give me? He goes, yeah. I'll give you 10 to 1.
Wow, there you have it.
So I said, you're telling me that you think there's less than a 10% chance that Trump is going to win. Well, I said, I think there's a 40% chance he's going to win. So I took the bet. Turned out he won. I could have been wrong. I was thinking I was going to lose my money. But if somebody's giving you 10 to 1 on a 40% chance thing, you should do it.
Yes, you're going into the area of arbitrage and asymmetric information, even something like that, and that's an advantage.
Exactly. At some point, there is, you know, enough potential rewards on the table, like a 10 to 1 return, to even enable you to do low probability bets, which is again angel investing, right? You know. Why write a $50,000 check? Because I could make 100 times my money. I might lose my whole $50,000 more often than I'll make 100 times my money, but you don't have to make 100 times your money very many times to make up for all those other times.
Martin, you're officially invited back into the show because you're very entertaining and you have excellent, fresh ideas, and we need more of those. I really thank you for your time today. And is there anything else you'd like to kind of send out to the audience and maybe how they can connect with you or get engaged with your work?
Yeah, sure. I would be happy if people just checked out my website, incisive.vc. I post a lot of stuff up there about how I think about angel investing, and I'd be happy to talk to any companies that think they might want to partner with me to fundraise and other investors. Angel investing is a team sport. Startups are a team sport, and I'd love to meet anyone in that area. Thanks for your time.
We've had amazing guests on the show, and I'm very grateful for all of your support. The show is now available also on Google. It's available on Amazon. It's available on pretty much all the platforms, iTunes. We would love any positive feedback you could give on iTunes, especially. Leave us a review and keep listening. Appreciate it.